The crack house on the Miami street goes quiet before the men even finish coming through the door. 5 people die. Among the dead is a pregnant woman found on her knees, hands folded, in a position that investigators will later describe, with the flat effect of official language, as suggesting she may have been begging for her life. It is November 1984, and the case will eventually find its way into a 62-count federal indictment. But on this particular night, it is just a crime scene in a neighborhood where crime scenes do not always produce witnesses. The detectives who work it note something in the operational pattern, the speed, the completeness, the absence of anything left behind, but the name they are looking for will not surface in their paperwork for years. In the early reports, there is one small detail that gets filed without emphasis. The people who did this did not take the product. They took something else, something nobody could identify, something that didn't appear on any inventory. His name is Vivian Blake, and the most dangerous thing about him is not that he is violent, it is that he is not. He was born in Kingston on May 11, 1956, and the neighborhood that made him was Tivoli Gardens, a garrison community in West Kingston where the Jamaica Labor Party had built something that looked, from the outside, like public housing, and functioned from the inside like a sovereign state. The word garrison carries a meaning most outsiders miss. It does not describe a neighborhood. It describes a complete parallel system, one where political loyalty is the price of safety, where the Don manages welfare and violence with equal fluency, and where the state only enters on terms negotiated at the street level. To grow up in Tivoli Gardens in the late 1960s was to understand power, not as theory, but as weather, something you felt constantly on your skin, and learned to read before it turned. Blake was, by every account that survives him, genuinely uncomfortably intelligent. He read, he watched systems, he understood how things moved. And in 1973, at 17 years old, he boarded a plane to New York City as part of a traveling cricket exhibition. He never went back, not because he was running, because he had seen something. New York, in 1973, was broke, burning, and structurally wide open. Blake, young and undocumented, began where many Jamaican migrants in his position began. Marijuana, street level, watching how money moved and where it slowed down. What separated him from every other young man running the same game was that he did not see the corner. He saw the architecture, where the margin leaked, where the risk concentrated, where a different model would produce a different result. He began quietly to build one. Back in Kingston, the 1970s elections between Edward Sega's JLP and Michael Manley's PNP had turned garrison communities into armed camps. Lester Lloyd Coke, Jim Brown, was consolidating muscle in West Kingston, guns, votes, bodies. According to multiple reports, the CIA provided arms, training, and transport to JLP-aligned posse members during this period, a claim that remains one of the most volatile footnotes in Jamaican criminal history. What is not disputed is the result. By the end of the decade, there were fully formed, heavily armed, politically trained Jamaican crews living in New York and Miami, stripped of their original purpose and looking for a new one. Blake was waiting for them, the genius of what he built, and it was, by any structural measure, genius, was that it did not look like anything law enforcement already had a template for. Not the Italian-American model, with its fixed hierarchies and mappable territories. Not the Colombian model, with its massive container ship loads that moved efficiently but left enormous footprints. Blake's model was cellular, distributed, and deliberately fragmented. Smaller loads, higher frequency, a wider human network. The women he recruited, some of them higglers, Jamaican market traders who already made regular Kingston to Miami flights carrying secondhand clothes, moved cocaine packages on their bodies through customs lines that were not looking for them. The product moved inside the noise of ordinary Caribbean migration, invisible because it had been designed to look like everything else already moving through those airports. From Miami, it spread. New York first, then up the East Coast, Washington, Philadelphia, Baltimore, Boston, then west into Kansas City, Chicago, Detroit, Los Angeles, and beyond. By the mid-1980s, the Shower Posse controlled distribution cells in more than 20 American cities, with operations reaching as far as Alaska. Blake's half-brothers, Errol Hussing and Tony Bruce, ran New York, the most competitive market in the country. One crew member, Kirk Bruce, would later confess to more than 100 murders. Federal prosecutors would eventually allege that Blake's organization was directly or indirectly responsible for over 1,400 drug-related killings across America. Attorney General Richard Thornburgh would describe what the Pazes had built as urban terrorism. Not rhetoric, but a clinical description of a strategy designed to collapse local drug markets through overwhelming violence and then move into the space left behind. And still, in every file, every task force memo, every grand jury exhibit from this period, there is a gap. The investigators can see the network. They can trace the routes. They can name the soldiers. What they cannot find is the document, the operational blueprint, that should explain how all of it was coordinated across 20 cities without collapsing under its own weight. Some assume it was never written down. Others assume it was destroyed. The gap sits in the record like a missing tooth, and nobody can agree on what was ever there. Crack cocaine does not create poverty. It descends on it. The Shower Posse did not go to broken neighborhoods because it was evil, though the violence it brought was monstrous and real. It went because the margins were highest there, and because a man who understood systems had already calculated exactly where the demand was and exactly how to service it at scale. The New York Times, the Los Angeles Times, and Mother Jones would all eventually describe what Blake's generation of traffickers had pioneered as the architectural model for the modern domestic drug trade, the template for how an international narco supply chain could be industrialized across a continental market. He was running it from Fort Lauderdale, driving a clean car, attracting almost no attention at all. In September 1988, a federal grand jury in Miami hands down an indictment that the Justice Department treats as historic. 62 counts, 34 named defendants, racketeering, gun smuggling, drug trafficking, multiple murders, including the 1984 crack house killings. The charges reach into Brooklyn, the Bronx, Los Angeles, and across the water to Kingston. At the top of the American operation, named clearly Vivian Blake, maximum exposure, 390 years. The Organized Crime Drug Enforcement Task Force coordinates simultaneous arrests across Baltimore, Boston, Cleveland, Denver, Detroit, Houston, Kansas City, Las Vegas, Los Angeles, New York, Philadelphia, and Washington. It is the largest coordinated strike against Jamaican organized crime in American history. Blake is not in any of it. He is already on the water. He moves through the Miami terminal the way a man moves when he has somewhere ordinary to be. Unhurried, unremarkable, one traveler among thousands. He has a ticket. He has luggage. He boards a cruise ship bound for Jamaica while his half-brothers are being walked out of a building in handcuffs in New York. The ship pulls away from the dock and the Miami skyline shrinks behind the stern, and the water goes green and then blue, and then the color of nothing in particular, and somewhere on that ship Vivian Blake is just a passenger watching the American coast disappear. No sirens, no chase, no scene, just the sea and the distance growing between him and everything the federal government has spent 2 years building. Who warned him? Which call came in? Which politician picked up the phone? Which thread in his intelligence web gave him the hours he needed? Has never been established in any public record. This is the part of the story that federal investigators in two countries, across 11 years of pursuit, never fully resolved. Blake had people everywhere. And the question of exactly which people, and what they knew, and when they said it, remains open. He walks off the gangway in Kingston, and into the warm air, and the rest of his American chapter closes behind him like a door. What comes next is its own kind of audacity. He does not go underground. He opens a nightclub, Cactus, and a motorcycle rental business, and a loans company. He becomes in the visible daylight of Kingston commerce, a businessman. The Jamaican government resists the American extradition request for years, giving him legal and social room to operate in plain sight. He moves through the city with the ease of a man who has done the math and concluded that the cost of coming after him is higher than anyone is currently willing to pay. The Americans keep building the case. In January 1994, he is arrested in Jamaica on an extradition warrant. For 4 years, his attorneys fight through the Jamaican Supreme Court, double criminality arguments, procedural challenges, evidentiary attacks. He nearly wins. In July 1999, the extradition goes through. He is 43 years old when he lands in Miami. The government's star witness is a convicted trafficker with enough history to be dismantled on cross-examination. Rather than risk a jury, Blake negotiates. In 2000, he pleads guilty to racketeering, criminal conspiracy, and cocaine possession. Leadership role confirmed, no murders admitted. Judge Norman Rocker sentences him to 28 years. He serves 8. He is paroled and deported to Jamaica in January 2009. 14 months later, on March 21, 2010, he has a heart attack. He is admitted to the University Hospital of the West Indies on a Saturday. He dies on Sunday. He is 53 years old. The New York Times runs the obituary. AP moves the wire. In Kingston, people receive the news the way they receive all news about men like him, with a feeling that has no clean name, somewhere between grief and relief and the recognition that the story was never really about one man. He had come to New York on a cricket team, 17 years old, with a scholarship mind and no legal path, and he had looked at a broken American city and seen with a terrible precision exactly where the demand was and how to build the supply. He had taken a political enforcement crew and turned it into a multinational distribution network operating across 20 cities and into Alaska. He had introduced a cellular, high-frequency smuggling model that other organizations studied and replicated long after the Shower Posse's American operation had been dismantled. And he had done all of it while keeping his hands in every courtroom where the question was formally asked, technically clean. The operational blueprint, the document, or the ledger, or the plan that should exist somewhere, was never found. It went with him, or it was never written, or it was destroyed so carefully that no investigator in 2 countries ever located a single page of it. The man who built the architecture of the modern international drug cartel model took whatever remained of its design with him on that Sunday morning, and by the time Kingston knew he was gone, the system he built had already been running without him for years. Which raises the question that nobody in law enforcement ever fully answered, and nobody who knew him ever publicly settled. Was the cruise ship escape the move of a man who saw everything coming, or was it the one moment of luck that an otherwise flawless operator was never supposed to need?